Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the ImpactVest podcast, transformative global innovation in a new era of impact. I'm Aisha Williams, the founder and CEO of ImpactVest, and along with our guest host, we aim to inspire and motivate towards collective positive global impact to solve our world's most pressing challenges in sustainability. With each episode, we will engage in insightful conversations with global changemakers, visionaries, and sustainability activists who wish to build a more sustainable and resilient future. Join us now as we create the future of impact.
Welcome, everyone, to the ImpactVest podcast. I'm your guest host today, Paul Ellis, and I'm also the host of the Sustainable Finance Podcast. Today, consumers and investors are seeking global responsibility for the social and environmental impacts of their investments and are demanding enterprise-level transparency in corporate reporting and supply chain disclosure through sustainable finance industry outlets. Cato Muir is a cultural leader and traditional owner of the Nahlia people. His traditional territories are in the deserts of Western Australia, and his people are part of the Western Desert Cultural Bloc, the last regions of Australia to be settled by Europeans. Cato, welcome to the podcast for today's conversation.
Oh, thank you, Paul. I'm really pleased to be here with you and your audience.
Yes, well, we're glad you could join us from the land down under, as they say, right? The other side of the world. So, Cato, the Nahlia people have around 23,000 square kilometers of exclusive possession, native titled land, and you're potentially the largest landowners in Australia, and yet your people remain in poverty. Why is that?
It's a part of the circumstances of the nature of colonization and the dispossession and marginalization of Indigenous peoples. And so what happens is that the infrastructure that is established in a post-colonial, so Australia being a post-colonial society, has served to exclude the First Nations or Indigenous peoples from effective participation. And so where once we held sway over most of the territories in Australia, the process of imperialism and colonization has resulted in the First Nations being dispossessed and marginalized politically, economically, socially. And where we are today is essentially in a transition of recovery from the effects of those forces of colonization, which commenced about 200 years on the East Coast in Sydney. But in my region where I come from, it's my grandparents' generation who first experienced the full impact of, the coming of Europeans into our region and subsequently the, taking up of land for gold mining, nickel mines, those kinds of extractive industries, as well as pastoral, the grazing of sheep and cattle. And that essentially has resulted in land being taken away from us. But in recent years, with the advent of the Mabo native title decision in the High Court of Australia, we were able to start to seek reparations and restitution of these lands.
Okay. Now, as you just mentioned, in recent years, First Nations in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada have been building on the processes of restitution through treaties and land settlements to reclaim wealth in First Nations. Yet, despite increasing access to extensive land holdings, significant impediments are preventing Australia's First Nations people from effectively mobilizing your resources. What is preventing the mobilization of those resources for your people?
Yes, there are two key areas. One is the nature of the laws that are written to allow for the recognition. And some of these laws in the legislation itself specifically preclude commercial activities. And what it does is it creates a system of dependency, which is often reflected in welfare dependency, but it creates that dependency on welfare from the state and prevents us from being able to access, take and use our resources of our territories in the form of trade or in the form of production of goods or services. Now, that has been part of the process that we've been engaged in restituting and repatriating our lands. It's also to create the opportunity to free up essentially the equity that resides in that land. And so what comes into the second part of the challenge, though, is the legal parameters are unclear. So a lot of these lands fall into a informal category of tenure and financial instruments. And so the capability to raise finance against what is essentially inalienable or infungible territories prevents us from actively participating in the market economy. And so what we're then faced with is the challenge to try and find creative ways of participating. One of the traditional manners, of course, is to rent our lands to third parties, which may include mining industry or renewable energy projects, etc. But the other way is to start looking today at the sustainable finance industry, initially at the responsible investment frameworks, but also in terms of the nature-based solutions as they relate both to capital carbon, but also as they relate to the recognition or realisation of the biodiversity, potential for biodiversity credits.
Okay. Cato, can I enter? I had a question about nature-based solutions. There may be members of our audience who are not familiar with that terminology. Could you explain that a little bit more for our listeners?
Absolutely, yes. There is a movement afoot, and it's basically happening as we speak at this very moment. The world financial sector are basically developing what they call transactions for nature-based disclosures. And my understanding is that the SEC in the US is actually, and I think I might have heard this on your podcast before.
I hope you did.
Yeah. But my understanding is that the SEC has implemented implemented requirements that companies start to disclose their impact on nature in the way in which they go about their business.
Yes, in fact, yes. Let me jump in here for a second to just comment that the SEC is promulgating regulations, which have not come into force yet. They will later this year, regarding ESG reporting requirements for enterprises of all public company nature. Of course, that's the group of businesses in our economy that the SEC is in charge of. So far, the reach is not going to the private market space, but you're absolutely right. Regarding the public markets, and hopefully you did hear that on our podcast, the SEC will be issuing regulations, and a lot of companies are scrambling to get ready for that kind of reporting here in the U.S. So go ahead.
Yes, no, totally. And it's happening here in Australia as well in terms of companies that may be dual listed both on the Australian Stock Exchange and on the SEC. I think it's on the New York Stock Exchange. And so what we're finding is that there are environmental firms that are basically building that capability or capacity to do nature-based methodologies and understand what the methodologies are. And they're also, some of the mining companies are actually starting to employ people who claim to have a skill set, which, you know, it's a completely new frontier in terms of a skill set. But there are companies mobilizing to position themselves to be able to participate in those reporting mechanisms.
Now, if you were in that position working for a mining company, or if I was, what would our remit be? What would we be responsible for in terms of nature-based solutions, for example, that a mining company should be considering?
Well, there are basically impacts on threatened species. So where a operation may impact a habitat, or it may impact a migratory pattern in terms of tailings dams, things like that. So the company will then need to be able to develop responses to be able to manage the impact of its operations, and in the best case scenario is to ensure that the operations have no impact on the survival of whether it's an animal species or a flora species, or also develop the mechanisms to actually manage any impacts. So, and there are other things like offset mechanisms as well, which look at, although it's difficult to be able to define a adequate offset mechanism where a survival of a species may be at stake. And so this is, it's a really important issue across the world, and it's actually, I would argue that it's actually the 90% of what, the carbon market is probably just 10% of this bigger issue.
Yes, I would agree with you. And, of course, the carbon markets offsets that are being developed and offered on many stock exchanges and commodities exchanges in the developed economies are designed ultimately to reduce carbon pollution in the atmosphere. So that could certainly be applied to nature-based solutions, I believe, as well as atmospheric conditions. Right?
Yeah. Hopefully, you're reducing so a methodology around human reduced, reducing human impact on carbon, but also some of the offset models are basically designed around investing in nature-based programs that essentially invest in the ecosystem, and in that ecosystem, nature basically is supported and enhanced to perform its natural functions, which also include a capacity to capture and store and sequester carbon.
Now, could you give us an example from the Western Australian region that you live in of a potential nature-based solution that you think is necessary to happen there?
Well, I mean, part of what I'm doing in my territory, you know, as we say, we've got 24,000 square kilometres of land that is essentially pristine. This land has, we only have one road going through the entire territory, a track, not a road. It's actually a four-wheel drive track, and there are remains of vehicles that have never made it on the side. But, yeah, so that, and we're in the desert. So where my country is, we've got three of the great Australian deserts, the Great Victoria Desert, the Gibson Desert, and the Sandy Desert. And so in that space, it's a very rich bioregion. And so partly what we'd be looking at doing is to be able to document the elements of the nature that we have within the desert, and then to start to manage that environment in such a way that we can then potentially create financial products which support the active management of people on the ground. So it also delivers social outcomes, social impacts, but also the environmental impacts. And in that way, companies that are seeking to offset, you know, obviously the better scenario is that you don't damage the environment. But if you find yourself in a position to, you know, where governments also identify targets, the offsetting model seems to come into, you know, click into operation. And that's the opportunity for traditional owners of, you know, these otherwise infungible territories may be able to apply and deploy technologies. So everything from remote sensing and mapping software to environmental surveys through to then documenting and describing that in a format that then can lead to creating, you know, packaging it up into a fungible form. So that's essentially the projects or the activities. As a real-life example of that happening at the moment in the carbon sector is a lot of, there's a methodology in the Savannah, Northern Australia, where Aboriginal people are going back to traditional fire management regimes, and they're actually burning country. And in the process of burning country, they're actually having an impact on the carbon that's being released. Mm. Your listeners might think, oh, that doesn't make sense.
Well, what I know is that you're talking about systems of data collection, data analysis, and then developing protocols for addressing nature-based issues through data analysis, which is, from my perspective, very similar to what's being done all over the world when it comes to nature-based solutions. So it doesn't sound foreign to me, but you know, I know there are a lot of people who are don't understand much about the way that we're performing analytics in sustainable finance these days. Now, before I let you go for today, Cato, I would like to find out about any transitions that you're aware of to carbon tracking, any other things that you're thinking about using or your people are thinking about using in your territory that look like they may be able to support some of the work that you need to do in order to reclaim the value of the country and keep it pristine and keep it healthy for the future.
Yeah, now this is why we find an alignment with sustainable finance with the sustainability sector is that we have common objectives. And so our sustainability is really in two parts. One is the, three parts actually. One is the methodology that you've just described of, documenting, describing, and representing it. The other bit is around then looking for investment or people to invest in sustainability projects over a longer term. So it's not a 3-year, investment horizon. This would be a much more longer term. And then our strategy is even longer term again, on intergenerational time horizons. And the big part of what we invest in also is the sustainable livelihoods for our people, but also an investment in our young people with education and exposure to what we call two-way science, which is engaging with Western scientific traditions, but also matching that up with the traditional Aboriginal scientific or worldviews. And in that, we basically enliven or bring to life a new way of seeing the world, both from the scientific viewpoint, but also from a traditional cultural viewpoint.
Great. Well, listen, we're about out of time today. I'd love to revisit this conversation at some time in the future. Thanks again, Cato Muir, cultural leader and traditional owner of the Nalia people. I'm Paul Ellis.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to the ImpactVest podcast, Transformative Global Innovation in a New Era of Impact. Join us next week for another episode and become part of our ImpactVest newsletter community, where you will receive all of the latest updates about our work in this new era of innovative impact finance. See you next week as we create the future of finance at ImpactVest.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.